This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the Library Science Channel of New Books Network. My name is Jen Hoyer, and today I'm speaking with Grazia Ingravale, author of Archival Film Curatorship, Early and Silent Cinema from Analog to Digital, published by Amsterdam University Press in December 2023. Archival Film Curatorship is the first book-length study that investigates film archives at the intersection of institutional histories, early and silent film historiography, and archival curatorship. It examines three institutions at the forefront of experimentation with film exhibition and curatorship: the AI Film Museum in Amsterdam, the George Eastman Museum in Rochester, New York, and the National Fairground and Circus Archive in Sheffield, UK. A closer look at these three institutions provides a unique take on the shifting definitions, histories, and uses of the medium of film by those tasked with preserving and presenting it to new digital age audiences. Grazia Ingravale is assistant professor in film at Queen Mary University in London. Grazia, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen. Thanks for your invite.
Of course. And before we start talking about the book, I would really love if you could introduce yourself a little for listeners. Maybe if you can share a bit about where you grew up, what kind of path your education took, and what brought you to your work with film and film archives.
Right. Thanks for this introductory question. Thanks for your invite, Jen. And I'm really excited to do this interview for No Books Network. So I'm from the south of Italy. I was born in that part of Italy called Puglia. I typically refer to it as the heel of the boot. I actually majored, I did not major in film or archival and library science. I majored in philosophy. And I suppose I grew up in a family. My parents were school teachers. They're now retired, and a family of cinephiles. And so when I then started studying cinema later, after finishing my first master degree in ethical and political philosophy, I moved to Stockholm and I started studying cinema. And when I encountered the first few texts in film studies, some film memories came back in a sort of Proustian ways. I remember that I watched The Piano, Jane Campion's film, with my parents when I was like maybe 10. And then I encountered Vivian Sobchak's phenomenological analysis of this film. And so my encounter with cinema was with, you know, a dubbed cinema. Everything was, there was not an Italian film, was dubbed in Italian. Then I attended a film club. I started attending the Venice Film Festival. And I transitioned into cinema film media studies. I did an MA in Stockholm, and then I did my PhD in film studies at St Andrews in Scotland. But I should say that my interest in film archives more specifically stemmed from a cinephilic encounter. The first time really that I set foot in a cinematheque, in a film archive. And that was at the Stockholm Cinematheque, which is in this beautiful building, the Filmhuset, which is where the headquarters of the Swedish Film Institute, the Swedish Film Archive are located. And I watched a silent film with live music, piano accompaniment for the first time. It was Buster Keaton's The Navigator, and it was projected on analog 35mm, and I was in awe. I was like, wow, this is basically like, you know, this historical object that after a century is now being re-exposed, re-presented to a digital age audience. For me, it was like, this is like a historical object that is resurfacing. So obviously coming from, you know, the archaeological richness of a country like Italy, for me, it was akin to say like a Pompeian mosaic coming back, you know, to life after, you know, after a long time from a different world and coming into the present. And so obviously I was in awe, and I had never quite really reflected on the fact that cinema really had a history, was something with a history. And so I suppose that at the same time that I started engaging with key texts in film studies, and I had this encounter with what we might call film heritage, that's when I started being interested in how do film archives, how do cinematheques and film museums bring these over a century long films to speak to the present?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for that. So then I guess turning to this book, you really focus here on how these film archives are not only preserving and giving access, but really playing the role of interpreter and mediator for the films that they care for. So how did you arrive at writing this book? And what were some of the goals that you had in writing about what you describe as the heritageization of moving images?
Yes, I also have that problem. I can write it, but I'm not sure I can say it. So, I mean, I suppose when I started thinking about these questions of early silent cinema as coming from a completely different visual culture, media culture, from the one that we are accustomed to today, from the one that we consume, from the one that really makes up the urban home environment in which we move around, the culture of moving images, of screens. So when I started thinking about these questions of early and silent cinema on the one hand and digital technologies of on the other, it was in the early part of the 2010s, and I feel that, you know, this media landscape was dominated by what I read, what I thought as a key contradiction. So on the one hand, you had, you know, this mass institutional and amateur digitization and circulation of archival footage on platforms like YouTube, or you had, say, for instance, in my book, I make the example, I bring up the example of British Pathé that in, I think, 2012, released thousands and thousands of digitized clips from its archive. Also, film archives and museums started digitizing progressively larger portions of their collections. So you had, you know, this ubiquity of archival material on our digital platforms. As say, for instance, the head curator of iFilm Museum, Giovanna Fossati, said in an interview, which then I incorporated in my book, early and silent cinema had never been so visible as they became thanks to amateur institutional digitization and circulation online. On the other hand, if you, on the one hand, you had this ubiquity of archival footage, on the other, in the very same years, you had basically what at the time seemed the inevitable obsolescence of cinema in its analog form. So say in 2012, across 2012 and 2013, Kodak filed for bankruptcy, Fujifilm discontinued analog film stock manufacturing. So you had this media landscape, this heritage, film heritage landscape dominated by this contradiction between ubiquity and disappearance. Obviously, this was also a different period within the digital age. I feel like that now we are in a different period of the digital age dominated by the promises and threats of AI, but then it was a different time. We were all kind of investing digital technologies and new media practices with expectations of participation, democracy, universal access, and so on. So yes, I started thinking about how film archives and film museums intervened in this contradictory a configuration of the media landscape. How would they mediate that contradiction? What kind of histories of moving image media were they telling from the earliest days to the present day? And early and silent cinema felt like the perfect entry point because the language of early cinema, I mean, early cinema is incredibly anarchic in form, in themes. You know, it was dominated by a diversity of entrepreneurs, much more than it was later on when cinema became progressively integrated an industry. So you had the craziness of early cinema, which is so different from contemporary cinema. And then you have the extremely stylized and almost Manichaean sort of character of a lot of silent cinema, different acting, also a freedom in montage that, you know, also became formalized and institutionalized with time. So, you know, I always say to friends that are not silent film experts, say, when you watch a silent film, you can't get distracted because, you know, in a blink of an eye, there's a completely different scene and action taking place in many silent films. Many silent films were incredibly experimental in their use of montage, of camera work, of camera movement, and so on. So early and silent cinema were a perfect entry point to interrogate, you know, how do these institutions actually make contemporary audiences, help contemporary audiences make sense of this strange and now unfamiliar cinema, maybe also using digital technologies.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you explore this question in three different chapters that are focusing on three different institutions who have all exhibited and curated early and silent films. And you start off with the Eye Museum in Amsterdam. So looking at Eye, you discuss a lot of their programs to support digital remix of early film samples. And so for listeners who aren't familiar with Eye, could you share a little bit about the history of that institution and then describe the impact of their various projects to support remixing fragments of the archive?
Sure. So maybe it's nice to begin by giving listeners like an image of the Eiffel Museum. So the Eiffel Museum is this beautiful, almost eye-shaped, of course, a stylized eye sort of shaped building, ultra modern, aerodynamic building that sits on the banks of the River A. So I is kind of a pun that refers to, you know, to the visual, various visual forms of expression, and also to the river that separates Amsterdam, the old town of Amsterdam, from Amsterdam North. So it's a beautiful building, and it sits just minutes away from the central station. I invite everyone to go and have a look. It's a beautiful building. But before finding a home in this hyper-modern, cool building, the museum was called Netherlands Film Museum. It's so the idea of instituting a Dutch archive for film dates back to the 1920s, but the museum adopted the name Netherlands Film Museum in the early 1950s. Now, what was interesting for me about the Netherlands Film Museum's history into the Eiffel Museum's history and its contemporary practices was that, just like the other two institutions, the Georgisma Museum and the National Fairground and Circus Archive, this institution not only experimented with digital exhibition, digital access, new media practices, and incorporated them within the repertoire of curatorial and exhibition practices that the archive uses, but also theorized about the use of digital technologies in this field. So it is interesting that already from the late 1980s, the museum, at the time called Netherlands Film Museum, or NFM, started experimenting with recombination. So archivists and curators noticed with sadness and grief almost, that film vaults, archival vaults are full of fragments, film fragments, unidentified film fragments. And because it is hard to archive them, because sometimes they're a few seconds long, so even duplicating them for preservation purposes is difficult because they're so short. They are difficult to index and catalog because there is no name, no title to, or author to link to these fragments. And so they typically are disposed of. And so they started thinking about ways to salvage them, really, to make sense of them. And they started splicing all these fragments, analog fragments, together. And then they duplicated this sort of compilation of film fragments onto a safety stock, on acetate. And by doing so, they experimented with new ways of preserving and eventually exhibit these films. So adapting the practice of found footage filmmaking, which repurposes fragments of found footage, they basically invented a new way of, gave new life to these otherwise neglected, discarded fragments, snippets of film history. That very same gesture of recombination is to be found in the remix practices when the analog film sort of becomes the digital sample. So the iFilm Museum, at the turn of the millennium, so during the 2000s and then in the 2010s, started digitizing a lot of its collections. It digitized early films, silent films, later films, and then it started experimenting with remix. And so it experimented with user-generated remixes. So for instance, it gave access to digitized film samples from its collections, using in some cases the same fragments that had already been used in the former example of found footage archiving, let's say. That earlier example went under the name of Bits and Pieces. So with this new experiment, the iFilm Museum provided access to digitized early film samples, silent film samples, and invited users to download them and to make up, you know, new films, new short films. And they also obviously provided some examples of uses that could be made with these. And there's very interesting results of these user-generated archival remixes. Then, you know, more recently, the iFilm Museum experimented also with algorithmic remix. So for nearly 6 years, the I launched this platform called YanBot that was generating 6 to 10, I think, short remix loops, basically matching news trends with the metadata associated with the digitized fragments fragments from the collection, again with mixed results. So I think that if one were to summarize why were these experiments with found footage archiving, with user-generated remix, digital remix, algorithmic remix, why were they important in the field? What do we learn from analyzing these archival remix practices within the longer history of the museum? I think that the iFilm Museum was really at the forefront of taking seriously digital technologies and the impact of digital technologies and media on the archival field, on film heritage institutions. And so really incorporated digital technologies in its restoration projects. So the iFilm Museum really became quickly identified with, you know, experiments with digital film restoration and with increasingly high quality digital restorations and even daring digital restorations. It really somehow forced the field to embark on processes of mass digitization, because mass digitization was the way in which, through digital technologies, the archive could open its vaults and its doors in a way that was unprecedented, and was not comparable to how we used to do it with video technologies and analog technologies. It also was, the iFilm Museum was also the forefront of engaging with what was becoming a new type of audience, the audience of the user spectator, the spectator that will not just engage with the institutions, film collections by going to, say, for instance, the Sunday silent film screening with live music accompaniment and sit there to watch a 2-hour long film. But also with a whole new bunch of spectators interested in film heritage, but they would do so according to different ways of engaging with those collections. So, you know, maybe dominated by shorter spans of attention and expectation to survey and to surf the collections, to get access to digitized collections, and maybe interact with these same collections. Of course, as with the other two case studies, I also offer some critical notes, some criticism of these practices. And as I said, when I started writing this book, we were at a time of the digital revolution when the democratic participatory promises of the digital were still there. You know, we were experimenting with participatory forms of curation, with bottom-up forms of content creation and circulation. But I question what I think in those very same years was happening to the notions of digital access, of participatory media. These terms were becoming increasingly opaque. And so I question whether these terms, these practices, these new media practices really harbor intrinsically democratic forms of access and interpretation of archival material, of film heritage. And so I argue that against the temptation to see digital access and engagement with digitized collections as intrinsically a good thing, we should interrogate digital engagement from a critical perspective. So digital access, digital engagement, for the sake of digital engagement is not enough anymore. So engagement has to come with criticism. This is, in a nutshell, some of the criticism that I offer out there, while of course praising and recognizing the incredibly visionary intervention that institutions like IFU Museum made at, you know, in those years, at that time in history.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it's so important to bring that criticism and ask those questions about who can really participate and how and what it's doing, even while, yes, as you say, these are like incredible and exciting projects that it would be neat to see more institutions do, but we have to do it like very carefully and consciously. And so then in chapter two, you explore the work of George Eastman Museum and their nitrate picture show. How has the George Eastman Museum historically focused on collection and curation? And what impacts has their changing curation strategy had at various points in time on the aesthetics of film as popular art, and then later on an understanding of film prints as art objects?
Yes. So again, in order to fully appreciate the intervention that the George Eastman Museum has made within the field and within the process of progressive obsolescence of analog film stock and the impact of that obsolescence in the way in which cinema is produced, cinema is consumed, and also from a formal perspective, and the possibility of actually being able to watch a film in analog form. So the Georgisma Museum made, I think, very important interventions, which were actually quite effective in raising awareness around questions around the near obsolescence of analog film stock. But before, in order rather to understand the impact of their curatorial intervention, I think we also need to take a step back and look at the history of the institution. So before the Georgisman Museum was called Georgisman Museum, it was the Georgisman House. And this was very much a post-World War II institution, which was originally conceived as a memorial to George Eastman, the father of Kodak. And then little by little, the museum grew into a full-fledged museum devoted to the art of photography and film. The very first film series at the Dryden Theater, which is, you know, the main exhibition space for the Georgisman Museum, the very first film series took place in 1951. So there's this mythical, almost mythical figure of the Georgisman Houses, as it was called at the time, the Georgisman Houses' first film curator, that is James Card. So James Card was a film buff, a film collector, a figure that, a bigger than life figure, I would say. And of course, a man who was curatorial choices, collecting practices are subject to criticism, as they should. And so basically, James Card started putting together the collection of the Georgisman House in antithesis and in a stern polemic against MoMA, MoMA's film library. So in the mid-30s, another mythical curatorial figure, such as Iris Barry and her husband, traveled to Europe and the Soviet Union in search of silent film masterpieces that they could take to New York City and that they could salvage from oblivion. And obviously, they set a canon for film history. This was one of the very first film archives that was embarking in such an enterprise. And that canon that they created was mostly European, Russian, Soviet, and focused on silent cinema, maybe avant-garde as well, avant-garde cinema. And so, as a very experienced collector, James Card knew that there were many films that Barry had left out, really. Films that were really an expression of cinema as a mass medium, as an art for the masses, for the millions of viewers. American viewers specifically were those that James Card had in mind. And so he knew that, say, films such as King Vidor's The Crowd, von Sternberg's The Docks of New York from 1928, Niblo's Ben-Hur from 1925, which are now considered masterpieces, they had been left out. And so, you know, he started putting together this collection made of films that had been great successes, that had been consumed avidly by hosts of millions of viewers, and yet were not part of the canon. And so he started at the same time theorizing in his speeches, in his film introductions, and then in his memoir this idea of cinema as a popular art, as different, as distinct from the more elitist sort of notion of film as art that MoMA's film library was building. Now, there was a certain anti-canonical revisionist drive in James Caird's operation there. And so, you know, when I started looking at the way in which several decades later, the George Eastman Museum was identifying analog film as fine art objects, the temptation was to see a continuity in curatorial discourses and practices. But as it is often the case, discourses had changed. The way in which cinema has been seen and preserved and valued as a form of art, as a culture, as a form of cultural expression has changed, also in relation to social changes, to technological changes. And so the more recent identification of analog film as fine art, let's say, emblematized, exemplified by the Nitrate Picture Show at the George Eastman Museum, is very different from what the museum was doing earlier. So for those of you there, for the listeners that maybe are not familiar with the Nitrate Picture Show, this is a festival that takes place yearly and has probably reached its 8th, 9th, or 10th edition, possibly. And the festival does not release its program until the very start of the festival. So you don't know. You may be traveling from New York City to upstate New York, or from the West Coast, or from Europe. You're going without knowing which film you will watch. But that's precisely the intention, because what is at stake there, what really matters, is that you're watching a film, you are watching an original Nitrate print of that film, because the idea behind it is that the way in which Technicolor or black and white look on Nitrate is different, which is true. I remember watching Hitchcock's Rebecca at the George Eastman Museum on Nitrate, and it is true that there is a different volume of the blacks in particular. There is a velvety quality to a monochrome image. That said, I think that Nitrate film, and through initiatives like the Nitrate Picture Show, Nitrate film allows a perfect identification of film as a fine art, as the George Eastman Museum has argued through its curators, Paolo Kerkyusai, in particular, has theorized this approach, and the museum more recently has continued building this specific take on analog film as fine art. So Nitrate film is a perfect example, because while acetate or any other archival print is a duplicate of an archival master. The archival master is that film print, or in the case of a negative, is that material that will not be used, that archival element that will not be used for exhibition, but will be consulted for preservation purposes to produce duplicates as a reference for restorations and so on. Whereas with the Nitro Picture Show and with Nitro Film, the museum was saying, this is the actual object. This is the actual museum object. This is the original. Now, again, as I clarified in the case of the Eiffel Museum, I think that there is a notion here, the notion of authenticity, that just like digital access in the case and participatory practices in the case of the Eiffel Museum, authenticity here is a currency that almost has value in itself. But actually, there's a whole hierarchy of values behind the identification of these nitrate films, of analog film more generally as the golden standard of film formats. And I argue that while the museum, as I said earlier, has been, I think, successful in building partnerships with the likes of filmmakers such as Tacita Dien, Christopher Nolan, but also with stakeholders such as Kodak itself, in raising awareness, in reintroducing the use of analog film stock in film production, in filmmaking. While that operation has been incredibly important, I think that there is a risk of abstraction. There is a risk of identifying analog film as this museum object where authenticity resides, that leaves out questions of contextualization, of interpretation, of the politics as well, of choosing particular films that make it into an archival collection. So the politics of acquisition, of collecting, of exhibiting. I use this term that I borrow from philosopher Hans-Georg Gadamer that is really central in my book. And I refer to this type of curation, this approach to curation as an aesthetics of abstraction. And I have to say there is also an autobiographical element when I was doing research in Rochester, upstate New York, in 2014, and then in 2016, I spent a few months in Rochester. It was quite striking to be able to be in the Dryden Theatre, this beautiful theatre, in this sort of very almost sacred and rarefied atmosphere, the auratization, the aura around maybe, you know, a 35 millimeter film screening, and then walking out. And these were the first trips that I was really ever taking, that I ever took to the United States. And in August 2014, there was the uprising in Ferguson following the killing of African-American man, Michael Brown. In 2016, there was the Black Lives Matters, an earlier instantiation of the Black Lives Matters movement. And of course, the museum, you know, didn't really have anything to do with those. But in a way, there was this contradiction. So maybe we need to question this curatorial approach based around the sacralization of analog film. And we need to maybe ask questions about in which contexts did film circulate and are films circulating?
Absolutely, yeah. And I felt like so many parallels in what you wrote in that chapter, really with like any kinds of collections where we decide that specific formats are more authentic and therefore have more value, and what that says about the institutions that have them and who gets to use them, and what it says about institutions that might only be able to afford facsimiles of whatever format. And I think it's really thought-provoking to ask questions about that and these strange values that we in fact are introducing without necessarily questioning it. And so then in chapter three, you turn to what felt to me like a very different kind of archive. I really enjoyed reading about the National Fairground and Circus Archive. And maybe you want to talk a little bit about what that archive is. And then I would love if you could explain for listeners how this archive helped really unlock the historical significance of the Mitchell and Kenyon film collection when it was refound. And then what we might understand is the impact of their specific approach to interpreting and curating that specific film archive.
Right. Yes, as you say, Jen, it is a very different institution from those that I explore and examine in chapter one and two. The National Fairground and Circus Archive was kind of was a case study that I considered for two reasons. The first is that was that it had exhibition practices that were very different from, say, the digital remix participatory practices that the eye was experimenting with, embracing the promises of digital access. And they were very different from the analog film exhibition practices that I was examining in the case of the George Eastman Museum. And so for those of you that are not familiar, I guess many of you might not be familiar necessarily with this institution, which is both national and local and international, because it is one of the most important collections of all sorts of media and material and records around the fairground, the circus, itinerant entertainment, popular working class entertainment, Victorian popular entertainment, optical toys as well. To a lesser extent, I would say. And the archive is part of the University of Sheffield's library's special collections. And it has a very particular history. And I will then, yes, I think it is, again, important to sort of trace a little bit the institutional history of this archive. As I was saying, I chose this archive because it was exhibiting, it exhibited early films in a completely different manner. It exhibited early films recreating and reenacting the way in which they would typically start circulating in working class towns in Northern England. So they would typically circulate in the fairground as part of various acts, including maybe, I don't know, fire shooting or animal performances in the case of fairground impresarios that had also that type of attraction included in their fairground shows. So the curator that really created what at the time was called National Fairground Archive, and that then came to be called National Fairground and Circus Archive because it acquired more collections related to the history of circus. The person behind this institution, Vanessa Tulmin, really had a key role in the creation of this institution. And on the, I say very specific, peculiar to some collections that it acquired, and also the exhibition practices that the archive put on. The other reason why I chose this institution, so different from the Eye and the George Eastman Museum, is that I didn't want to engage with film archiving and film curation only in relation to this opposition, this binary opposition between digital and analog. I really think that this case study offers us an opportunity to really read against the grain the politics, the cultural politics of historiography, of film exhibition, and of film archiving. So I have already offered some snippets of the history of this institution. So in the mid-90s, Vanessa Toulmin, a scholar from the University of Sheffield, a scholar coming from a fairground family, many of these families travel together with their shows. So she brought into this project her biography in a way, and she stewarded collaborations with fairground organizations in the UK that started donating periodicals, various types of records, chests of memorabilia, of memoirs, of fairground attraction designs. And so Vanessa Toulmin and the University of Sheffield found an institutional home for these records that didn't really have an archival home before. They were ephemeral records. It was a history that was largely oral. And that is a history that, in the case of, say, the United Kingdom, of Great Britain, goes back to at least the 14th century. Very early accounts, very early histories of the fairground are really centuries old. So this was a very interesting institutional history. But this history, as you mentioned in your question, kind of intertwined with the history of a particular collection. So in the same years that the University of Sheffield Library and the fairground organizations and Vanessa Toulmin were taking the first steps in establishing the National Fairground Archive, as it was called at the time, in those same years, a photographer and amateur film preservationist in the tiny town of Blackburn made a major film discovery. He found hundreds of reels of early films, early local films that had been shot by impresarios, by entertainment impresarios, and typically sold to fairground showmen and showwomen to be exhibited to local audiences in all the towns, really like in the Midlands, but also in Scotland and in Ireland. But I concentrate specifically on the circulation of these films in Northern England in my book. So these films were a bit of a mystery because they depicted scenes of community life. For instance, they had been shot by these two impresarios, Mitchell and Kenyon, and the collection is called Mitchell and Kenyon Collection. They had been shot, for instance, outside schools, outside factories, in order to shoot as many people as possible, because these films were then shown in the fairgrounds and people paid to see themselves on screen, which was somehow like an antecedent of the same kind of vanity principle behind a selfie. You know, a picture of yourself, you see yourself on screen. So very fascinating history. However, when these films were discovered, it was a puzzle. No one really understood what would the people wear, how these films circulated, and so on. And in particular, there were these handwritten names, words on the film strips, such as Green, such as Campbell. And it was only when the British Film Institute National Archive started collaborating with the National Fairground Archive that the real history the real history. Well, the history of the circulation of these films became apparent. And the names were the names of the fairground showmen that were exhibiting these films within the context of the fairground. So the key to really understand the history of these films was not that much in the artifact or in the filmic text, in the images, but was actually, there was a wider history to be told about the specific socio-cultural, economical milieu within which these films were created and circulated and exhibited. This was a time in which the very same filmic attraction could acquire all sorts of different meanings, from being a film about an educational film, the very same film, if it maybe featured a woman at some point, could be framed within a slightly erotic context. And this depended on how it was shown, what the lecturer, the film lecturer, the bonimenteur in French, would say while the film was being played. So the National Fairground Archive really helped unlock the secret to the history of these films and really shed light on the need to understand the world within which an archival record circulated. And in that way, it really foregrounded the politics of historiography, as I said, of exhibition and of curatorship, specifically because this ended up being a working class history, a history that then was revived when these films, when the National Fairground and Circus Archive re-exhibited these films in the very same communities, now in a post-industrial context where all those factories had been closed, where people, there were many examples of people feeling disenfranchised and so on, working class audiences were able to see a part of their history, and maybe some progenitors as well on the screen, and recognize maybe their community, the history of their community on screen. And so this case study really offers an opportunity for me to drive the point home that we need to interrogate the way in which any record is embedded in specific archival protocols, in a collection of metadata, in a specific material history that led that record from being created to being acquired and preserved in an archive, or in the case of a specimen, for instance, in a museum. A record is wrapped into specific acquisition policies, and as you were saying, a hierarchy of values that ascribes, that recognizes more prestige, more cultural value, more significance, more importance to some formats rather than others. So I think that this particular case study helps me bring this point to light.
Absolutely. This collection, like, it's so obvious in this collection how original interpretation and circulation were really, really key to the meaning of the films. But then it kind of makes you ask, wait, like, how was that there in other collections with other films where it doesn't stand out as the most obvious aspect? And then how are institutions changing that over time? It's, I thought this was a really, really thought-provoking example. So then wrapping up our discussion of your book, what do you really hope that readers, whether they're archivists, film scholars, non-archivists, what do you hope readers will take away with regards to understanding how different types of heritage institutions are historicizing film through discourse and through practice? And what questions do you hope we'll continue asking as archivists, as film scholars, as audiences about the role of the institutions that care for and curate our film collections?
So I should say that I have become acquainted with archival and preservation practices in the field of film preservation, film archiving, thanks to the generosity and the patience of the many archivists and curators present and past that have shared their knowledge with me, shared their time with me, helped me train myself into a field where I had not received any formal education. Of course, I did a lot of research around this and bibliographic research and so on. And I want to dedicate this book to the archivists and curators in this field, because I feel like that film archives and film museums are the younger cousin of the more established and more culturally recognized, archives of state records, for instance. There is almost a hierarchy of records, and moving images typically are at the very bottom of the type of records that historians will typically recognize as reliable. So this means that film archives and film museums are chronically underfunded, and that individuals working in this field, well, definitely have an ability to control anxiety that is beyond that you can find in any common human being, because the task is so daunting. There's so much work to do and so little time and money. And I'm talking about archives based in the global north. In the global south, there's all sorts of other impediments, questions that have to do with the legacies of colonial and imperial histories. This is really another strand of my more recent work. So typically in the field of archival science and preservation, professionals operate according to principles of authenticity, historical accuracy, provenance, and obviously there is a protocol in interpreting records and using the archival record as the ultimate reference point. And I understand that this is key to the work of archivists and preservationists. However, I think that while in a lot of the day-to-day operations, part of the archival workflow, this is very important, a principle that guides practices as well of preservation, I think that I would like, with my book, with my work, I am in continuing conversation with archivists and curators, and I would really like to invite them to take their work of historical interpretation and historical mediation between the world and the time in which the record circulated, and the many other worlds and times in which it has circulated throughout the archival history of the record until the present. When I say record, I also imply the specimen, because of course, film archives and film museums are hybrid institutions that cross the world, the institutional world, and the deontological world of the archive and that of the museum. But so my invite, my hope is really that film archivists and curators might take their work of interpretation and of mediation as one that extends much further than making justice to the authenticity of the archival record or of the specimen. There is a big responsibility in making these records, these early films, these silent films, meaningful in the present day. So this is my hope, and I'm really pleased with how professionals in the archival, in the film archival field, have been not just generous but also curious, open, to and receptive of this idea.
Super, thank you. And I know I've taken a lot of your time, but before we wrap up, I would love if you could share a little bit about whatever you're working on next. No pressure at all, but are there any new projects or research that you're turning to now that you've wrapped up this project?
Yes, thank you for your question, Jen. Indeed, like in the past few years, I have progressively moved to, well, I've built really on the work that I carried out in archival film curatorship in my book. And I have started interrogating questions of historical mediation when we deal with colonial archival films. So as many museums and archives in the global north, collections are full with material that dates back to the colonial era, and especially when dealing with early and silent cinema. Cinema, in a way, was a technology of the empire, of colonialisms. So the idea again here is really to work in collaboration with film archivists and curators in interrogating the politics of archiving and curating these incredibly difficult material. And the hope with my more recent work is that film archivists and curators and these institutions more broadly might be willing to lead a process of reconciliation that we need to have in post-colonial and in multicultural constituencies, countries, cities. So I'm hoping to be able to share more of my work soon. Some of it has already been published, has already appeared in the Journal of Cinema and Media Studies, for instance, and more will appear. So yes, maybe there will be another follow-up conversation about this other strand of work in the future.
That sounds fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this. Once again, today I've been speaking with Gracia Ingravale, author of Archival Film Curatorship, Early and Silent Cinema from Analog to Digital. My name is Jen Hoyer, and you are listening to New Books Network.